Hello, and welcome to In Line with Nature, the podcast that explains an approach to building that puts the future of our planet first, with me, Hannah McInnes. In this series, I talk to experts about modern-day construction, its impact on the natural world, and why the time for change is now. I'll be talking to our series of guests about new approaches to design, reimagining a built environment at one rather than at odds with nature.
Hi, I'm Julia Watson. I am a designer, an author, an academic, an activist. I wrote a book in 2019, published by Tushin, called Low-Tech Design by Radical Indigenism, which looks at the ways that Indigenous and local communities adapt their ecosystems as a new form, or an ancient form, however you think of it, of technology that is incredibly important and could be really catalytic in changing how we approach climate change issues today.
So you wrote that book brilliantly. Do you think those voices, apart from through your book, are enough at the table when it comes to talking about the built environment?
Definitely not. No, there are 18 case studies in my book. There are 5 interviews. There is not enough representation in the built environment from Indigenous experts, engineers, designers, scientists, ecologists at all. And the book was to provide a platform and to shine a light on different voices. And I think that there is still an incredibly long way to go before we really, I guess, decolonize the design profession and really give a proper seat at the table to Indigenous knowledge keepers who really have an incredible wealth of sophistication and intelligence in relationship to the built environment that we desperately need.
But do we desperately need it across the globe, or is everywhere very specific? How transferable are these ideas, or are they very specific to culture and to place and to history?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of ways you can think about how the knowledge can be used. There are incredible values to be learned from how nature-based communities think and practice and interact with their natural environment. So there's a set of values that I think we're lacking that we could learn that are somewhat universal. There's knowledge about particular ways technology can work, and technology as sort of separate types of technologies, agriculture systems, forest systems, desert systems. And then when you start talking about what you're alluding to, which is very place-based specific understandings, yes, there are understandings and technologies that come out of very specific locations which can be shared from those communities in those locations. But I think there's that, you know, level of macro, middle and micro understandings that could really have relevance universally and site specifically. So I think that there's an incredibly broad application, but also incredibly site specific application. And that's very interesting to think of it like that, because that's actually where the designers work as well. And if you think about climate change, it works universally, and we put universal caps, you know, how many degrees is the earth going to heat up? But then there's very site-specific responses to those universal understandings of climate change and climate impact. And we need those universal, broader understandings plus those site-specific understandings to respond to those site-specific climate impacts as well.
Mm-hmm. Could you give us some examples? I know there are so many. You said 18 in your book, but perhaps of both. So one that's very specific, or something that's transferable to.
Yeah, I think one that would be transferable, you know, broadly speaking, I think all of these are transferable, thinking about their application globally. But as sort of a category of types of technologies, one is a really good category because there's already an international means by which this knowledge is shared and transferred, is pyrotechnology. And pyrotechnology has been used all through the Americas. It's pyrotechnology is a fire stick farming or cultural burning, and it's
when local communities burn parts of their forests or their grasslands to prevent wildfire and to reinvigorate ecosystems. And so it's very intentional burning. It's very cool burning. It's very controlled burning. And it's done site-specifically in response to soil conditions, soil moisture levels, flowering times, animal breeding times, wind directions, weather patterns, seasonality, time of day. So that's very site-specific. But across the world, across the Americas, around the world, people have been using pyrotechnology for this means of prevention and ecosystem reinvigoration forever. And those in places that are experiencing incredible wildfires now, you can see in Spain or Portugal or, you know, in European countries where they don't have site-specific pyrotechnology practices anymore. That's where that information can be transferred from communities who have retained those practices to places that really need help in understanding how they can prevent extreme wildfires.
So how do you do that? Link these people up and get them where they need to be?
There's grassroots organizations and platforms that people have already been developing. So this is, you know, this is a very sort of on the ground, local grassroots collaboratives and cooperatives working and then organizing themselves and sharing internationally through networks that are set up between different cultural burning communities.
I mean, that's such a fascinating example. Actually, now I'm going to ask you for another one.
Yeah.
You're obviously, of course, you've done such research, so we need to tap your expertise because many of these aren't familiar to so many people.
Yeah, I think one example, and it's on the front cover of my book, is an example from the Wakasi who live in northeast India in a place called Meghalaya in the Jayanti Hills. And they're a community who have been growing living bridges for the last 1,500 years. They originally migrated, they think, up from Laos. However, this origin story of the people, of the Wakasi people, says they migrated down from a hole in the sky on a living root ladder that was a magical, sacred ladder. Some of the families came down to earth, some of them returned to the skies. The families that stayed on earth, they became the Wakasi people. And because they came on down on that living root ladder, which was a ladder grown from trees, they grow these living bridges. So the living bridges that they grow to cross over the rivers that become really swollen with the monsoon rains, they're also sacred. And they're a very similar name to that origin story, living root bridge. And so they grow these living root bridges by creating a bamboo scaffolding from one side of the river to another. About 20 years before that, they'll grow Ficus elastica fig trees. They'll plant them on either side of the river. And then after their secondary root system, which are these beautiful tangling, but then they grow down from the first row of branches. They then weave and twist those roots through the scaffolding of the bridge to the other side of the river. Once they grow long enough, they plant them into the opposing side of the river. And then the trees just actually grow through the scaffolding and create a bridge. And about 50 years later, they can cross that living bridge. Those living bridges, they grow for hundreds of years. They get stronger with age. They're the only living root bridges that can withstand the full force of those incredible monsoonal rains that come through this area. It's the wettest place on earth. They maintain these bridges. The men grow them, the women and the children then join them and maintain them for years and years. And what's really interesting about this example is that a great-great-grandfather might have planted your living root bridge. He would know that he would never be able to cross the bridge. He'd know that he'll never see in his lifetime this root bridge form. But he's doing that for the generations that come to come before him. So they're growing for, you know, multiple generations ahead of themselves.
So it's as much about what they're doing as the mindset that you think is transferable and important for people to understand.
Yeah, and the book is called Low Tech, which is amalgamation of two words, local and TEK. TEK stands for traditional ecological knowledge, and that's the knowledge about how to grow these bridges, how to maintain these bridges, where to grow them. And TEK, if you want to think about it in sort of a bit of a Western framework, it's a system of nested concepts. And at the top of that nest is an individual, and TEK is about that individual firstly understanding the local knowledge around them, secondly under that understanding how to manage the land and the resources that they're occupying. Below that is their societal interactions, who they have access to, who they influence, who's their kinship. And then below that, and getting to your question, is their belief system or their worldview. So traditional ecological knowledge and these types of technologies, they're technologies that are about understanding your ecosystem, how you manage that ecosystem, who's involved in the management of that ecosystem, and your belief systems about how human beings interact with their ecosystems. And so for that particular example, the way that the Wakasi understand how to interact with their ecosystem, they understand that they came down from heaven and became part of their ecosystem thousands, millions of years ago. Mm. And so they are part of nature. And that's a really different and very distinct belief system of the dominant culture of the world, which believes we are separate to nature.
And that is a dominant culture of the world. For years, modernity makes everyone think of, you know, progress, innovation, high tech.
Extraction.
It's wishful thinking, isn't it, to think that we can change that?
I don't think so. I think that we're moving into an era where we can't really keep that set of, or that paradigm that we're separate from nature when nature has such an all-encompassing impact on nearly, will have an all-encompassing impact on all systems that we've controlled and framed and conspired to sort of understand that lives separately and is not impacted by nature. With climate change, our government systems, our economic systems, our trade systems, our transportation systems, all of this is going to be disrupted. There's, if human, you know, dominant culture really believes that even though nature can disrupt everything, that we're completely separate from it and we can remain and maintain our ecosystems outside of the impacts of nature, then it's ridiculous, because that's not going to happen. So I think that there's going to be a shock of understanding how we have to integrate an understanding of nature into our large-scale systems. And I also think that on the human level, I think that there is a need and a want and a desire for individuals to connect with nature. And I think that connection is somewhat, it's almost like in its infancy, I think, because we forgot how to do that. And I think one of those really important understandings that we can gather from knowledge keepers and from Indigenous communities is, what are those values that come from humans who have been living with nature for millennia, and how can we learn some of those values and integrate those values into the way we live?
So it's about getting a balance, though, between high tech, which we've sort of waded very far into, and low tech. It's about going forward and learning from them, but probably accepting we can't peel away years of tech.
I wouldn't say balance, because I feel balance means like some sort of an equal. Mm. I would say a symbiosis. So there's, and a balance is a measurement, and I don't know how you would ever measure that, but a symbiosis between all the incredible sophistication and intelligence that we have evolved in the world that we live in today, which is high tech or however you want to categorize that, but then an integration and acceptance and, you know, an open arms welcome to ancient Indigenous knowledge and low tech.
Do you think it's happening a bit? I mean, we're
absolutely
here.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I think maybe 3-4 years ago, this wasn't the case. But there's been a really rapid change in, I think, people's perceptions and interest globally in different belief systems, different ways of relating to nature. And I think it's becoming, it's sort of seeding itself within a more dominant mainstream cultural frame. And so I think it's already happening. So that what we talk about paradigm shifts as if they're to happen. But I think like your question is like, where are we in that evolution of it already happening? And I mean, who knows, but it's absolutely definitively already on that pathway.
What's next for you? What are you working on now?
Next is a book, another book, sequel to Low Tech. Television series from the first book. A lot of it is about providing more public platforms that capture much larger audiences and bring more voices to this conversation. Working on really trying to set up platforms for knowledge keepers to share. So while I talked about platforms that are grassroots, I think that there's an opportunity for Low Tech to create a much larger global platform to integrate those sort of different platforms that are in existence. So an emergent platform for knowledge sharing. And then I think there we have to tackle the problem of why these types of bio-based technologies aren't making their way into cities and into the built environment. And there, I think, are a lot of reasons. Some of them are governance. Some of them are legal. Some of them are ethical. And we need to figure out how this transition happens and how it happens quickly, because there are systems set up to stop this happening. And I think we need to accept that. But we also need to acknowledge that there's a dire need and also an incredible desire for people to interact with their built environments in different ways through technologies and infrastructures that are organic, that have worked for millennia, and that include those values and those technologies and those symbiotic relationships and understandings. So that will bring our understandings and our relationship to the natural world to another level if we start to bring these types of technologies to the built environment. Mm-hmm. They're not only systems and infrastructures, they're also educational platforms for all of us to understand how to start to live with our Earth in a very different way.
And finally, you've been here at the forum for the past 2 days. I just wonder what your experience is in terms of whether it's changed your mindset about anything, whether people you've met have opened your eyes to something different, what that experience has given you.
I mean, I think it's been incredibly inspirational. I think the experience has made me understand, obviously, there are people from all over the world who are in different sectors of the built environment industry who are all working on these issues and trying to figure out how to make change. I also realize intergenerationally that this is a problem that people have been tackling either for 40 years, 20 years or 5 years. There has been an old guard and there is a new guard, and then there's a new generational guard to come still. And so the fight's just picking up and it's just becoming stronger and the movement keeps on growing. I mean, for me, I've had some incredible conversations and inspirational conversations, and I know going away from this that there's going to be quicker and swifter change now that we've been able to meet and convene.
Well, that is a very good thing to hear and a very good place to end. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to In Line with Nature, brought to you by the Closters Forum, hosted by me, Hannah McInnes, produced by Claire Heaton, and supported by the wonderful team at the Closters Forum. We'd love to hear your thoughts, suggestions, or any questions you might have about the episode. Just send your email to podcast@thecloistersforum.com and make sure to tune in for our next instalment.